it's time to take a listen to the interviews from last Saturday's Island Life. Island Life is our weekly magazine show, brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 by Island, the stockist of Waiheke's most eclectic collection of local gifts, art and clothing. You'll find them in Ocean View Road, Oneroa. Last Saturday, I caught up with writer and environmentalist Janet Hunt, local musician Aaron Carpenter, opinionated islanders Alan Knight and Mark James, and one of the organisers of the Great Waiheke Plum Drive, Jennifer Clamp. Okay, I've got in the studio with me award-winning writer and environmentalist Janet Hunt. She won the New Zealand Book Award in, 2004, I think it was. Is that right, Janet?
Yes, I won
2004.
I won one award in 2004 and another one in 2008.
2008 as well, yeah. And Janet will be known to people around the island as well for her work with Forest and Bird and with the Waiheke Islands Wetlands Initiative, and we'll find out more about those later. So welcome along to the studio, Janet.
Good morning, thank you.
And the occasion for Janet being here this morning is that she is departing Waiheke and moving to the Taranaki.
Yes.
Yeah. So we thought, well, good chance to catch up with someone who has had an impact on the island, and also the island has had an impact on her, and talk about that. So, Janet, you've written a lot about the environment, and you've been involved with the environment. Do you see yourself foremost as a writer or an environmentalist?
Ooh. I'm probably an environmentalist foremost, actually, yes. I mean, I'm a writer coming from a different angle. I'm a writer because literature and writing has been my background right through, but I've been an environmentalist probably since I was a kid, so yeah, I guess I'm an environmentalist first, yes.
And you had a farm upbringing, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Yeah,
yes.
And is that what sparked your environmental interest?
I think so, yes. Yes, I spent a lot of time outside on the farm, and our farm is right up by the Mount Taranaki bush. So we would go up into the bush with my dad, and you know, that was always something that I really enjoyed, and it was a sort of a highlight going in there. So I guess, yeah, looking back, and we've got, our farm is rather nice. It's got lots of little streams and rivers, and as children, we spent a lot of time outside. So, yeah, it just becomes part of the package, really.
And what drew you into the world of literature?
I think it was just being an avid reader from a very early age, and then when going to university and thinking, what am I going to do now? And English literature was something that appealed, so it was just became a natural extension of reading and writing and that kind of thing. Yeah.
And your first book that got published, I mean, it was quite a big book, wasn't it? I mean, a biography of Hone Tuwhare.
Yes.
You know, for a first-time published writer, a big subject.
It was huge. Although, I have to say, at the time, when I first started studying Hone, I was doing my master's, and nobody else had actually written about him much, and he wasn't seen by the academic world as being at that time especially, wasn't actually kind of given the credit, I think, that he deserved. And he was seen as a populist kind of a writer. So therefore, along with, you know, you have people like Alan Curnow and Kendrick Smithyman and all those, and they've got an element of difficulty and challenge and interest which is quite separate from somebody like Hone, who has a lot of popular appeal and goes out on the road and sells it to people. So when I came to write about him, nobody else had really taken him on. And so it just became one of those things where I think there's probably a feedback thing, because somebody is actually saying, I'm going to write a book about this person, then that actually focuses other people's attention on the person as well. So it was an interesting thing to do, and I was very lucky to happen to just choose to do that and meet Hone and get to know him and become part of his life and vice versa, yeah.
What was he like to work with?
He was a challenge in a lot of ways, because he was, for those of you who've known him, and a lot of people in Waiheke have, he never used to think in a very direct line. And so if I asked him a question, he'd go off on a tangent and he'd get he was hopeless to interview, actually, because he just rambled on and about all sorts of things. And then in his later years, he became very deaf. So, in fact, that compounded the problem hugely. He didn't hear what I was saying. And early on, I learned to just simply let him talk. And then I would go back through the interview afterwards and unpick what he said and work out which bits went with which bits and unravel it that way. So he was a challenge in that respect, but he was always kind to me and fun to be with, and it was a privilege to know him. So, yeah.
Okay, well let's have a chat about what brought you to Waiheke, because you've had two stints on the island, haven't you?
That's right, yes. Well, being a country girl, I had lots of friends who were moving to Auckland and didn't really want to go to Auckland, but wanted to be somewhere nearer to Auckland. And in the 80s, when I first came here, Waiheke was so different then because we didn't have fast ferries. And so there was more of a population of people who were retired, a lot of people who had dropped out of the normal economy for various reasons, whether they were alternative lifestylers or whether they were solo parents or whatever. So it was kind of a completely different, much more of a community, I think, much stronger community. Only one newspaper, which made it a very focused community. And so, yeah, so it was a pretty interesting time. But that's why I came here, because it was close to Auckland, so I could have the benefits of Auckland, but I could also be in a rural community.
And what part of the island were you in then?
I was in Rocky Bay, yeah.
Yeah, way out in the...
Which I didn't actually realise, even when we bought it, I didn't realise that it was quite as isolated as it is. Not that it's that isolated, really, but it's its own little community within the bigger community. In a way, all the other communities were more like that too, because each little village had its own store and its own focus, and people went to that little store for their shopping, and so there wasn't so much travel and vehicular travel around the island as there is now, because everyone goes to the supermarket, they all drive across the island. So it's been a big change, that fact that the supermarket's there and all the villages have pretty much broken down, really, apart from perhaps Rocky Bay and Onitangi, because they're out on their own a bit more.
And then you went away and came back?
That's right, yes. I didn't really intend to go away. I just went to Auckland for a short time, and I met Peter over there and ended up staying there for about 12 years. So then we finally came back, yes.
And so when you came back, you decided to you've got into your garden and kind of got very well established on the island, haven't you?
Yes, I guess so. I felt as though I was quite established on the island before, in a way, and so it was just a continuity thing. It was just picking up the threads where they were, where I'd had them before. But, yeah.
So one of the initiatives that you've been involved with since the last decade that you've been on the island is the Waiheke Islands Wetlands Initiative.
That's right.
Yeah. So tell us a little about that.
Well, that really only began in 2005, and it was an initiative of Forest and Bird, and it was because I think it was mainly Don Chappell's idea, and he said we need to have a little focus, a special focus on wetlands, because we were watching a wetland in the corner of Te Tauke Road being filled in at that time, and it was, you know, privately owned, and therefore, but it had been described as being degraded, and so that was like saying, okay, it's all right to fill it in because it is degraded, instead of taking it the other way and going and saying, well, it's a bit degraded, but we could restore it, we could work with the wetland. They simply obliterated the wetland, used it for a landfill effectively, and so they got. So, yeah. So we were watching that happen and decided that we wanted to advocate for the wetlands a bit more on the island, just to make people aware that they were there and what they are and, you know, the value of them, really.
And what were the other areas and projects that group got involved with?
We've spread ourselves quite widely. We had one little initiative which was incomplete, which was we decided we'd map all the wetlands on the island. That didn't actually... Well, it turned out to be just beyond us because we're too small a group to take on such a big task, although we did do quite a lot of work on that. We've just simply worked on, like, the high school wetland, which has been one of the initiatives that we've been involved in, which was very weed-ridden, and we've been instrumental in working with the schools to try and help that get that cleared up. And Tony Kingtuna's been the main driver behind that one. And then we've just been, we've sort of worked on things like the Okahuiti wetland and Te Tauke field, and we've the Matiatia wetland. So we've just been involved in promoting those wetlands and talking about them to people and taking walks around them, that kind of stuff.
And you've written a book about wetlands. Did that go hand in hand with your involvement in the group?
It came out of that, because I was working for the Gulf News for a while, and while I was there was when we were going out and looking at the wetlands. We had to find out about them ourselves first, and so we went out in the evenings and just had a wander around, and it was fantastic. It was really eye-opening, and so I started writing a little column called The Green Page in the Gulf News, and when I was asked, well, let's write a, what shall we write now, Janet, my publisher said, and I thought, well, why not a book about wetlands? And so it grew out of those, that interest in those wetlands.
Mm. It was one of the things I wanted to ask you, actually, about that, how these projects get initiated. Is it you saying, you know, I want to write a book about this particular bird or environmental issue or whatever, or is it more that you've become like the, I don't know, the Richard Attenborough of the New Zealand writing world? So we need a book about the environment. I know, ring up Janet.
Not quite yet, but anyway, no, this is a mix. Because I was lucky to write the Honi Tuwhare book, I worked at Random House. Then that I wrote A Bird in the Hand as a result of that, because I was there and they needed someone to write a book about birds, and I put my hand up. And then subsequently wrote another book, From Weta to Kauri, which was and that was initiated by the publisher. So I've been really lucky, because I've been in that position where they've asked me to do things quite often. And in the case of the wetland book, they said, well, what shall we do? You know, what do you want to work on now, Janet? And I sort of said, well, what about this? And so they thought about it for a while and said, yeah, okay, let's do it. So, but whereas for the latest book, which is E3, Call Home, a book about Godwits, that's was one that I had actually thought about doing a book about wetlands for children, and it was going to be, that was going to be one of the stories in the book. And then I sort of thought, oh, well, I'll see if Random House are interested, and they said, yeah, let's go for it. So it's a mix.
And some of, a number of your books are books for children.
Yes.
And is that part of the environmentalist coming out in you, teaching people about?
It is, yeah. And it's also because I was a teacher for quite a long time. I taught primary school. That was my first career. I've done a number of things, but that was the first thing I did, and I did it for quite a long time. So I'm interested in children, and because children are the people who are going to carry this stuff through into the future, that it's important that they be interested and encouraged to look at the environment and discover what's out there.
Yeah. And so, projects on the horizon?
I've got a few thoughts, including that wetland book that I just mentioned, one for children, maybe a book for children about wetlands, but also maybe another few angles on the wetland story I've also thought about. I mean, I've become a bit captured by this topic.
Now, another of your interests is gardening.
Yes, I don't know. Yes, I do like gardening.
Well, I mean, I've been to your garden on the Jazzy Dean Garden Safari once, I think.
No, it's never made that.
Oh, okay.
No. So, no, we did have had a nice garden. We have had a lovely garden here, but I wouldn't say it, that I wouldn't class myself as a great gardener. I'm a good gardener, but not a great gardener.
Right, yeah. And so now you're off to the Taranaki.
Yes.
Change of environment.
That's right, yeah. Yes.
And continuing with writing is the main focus?
That's one of them, yes, that's right. And my family is still down there, obviously, so that's another reason for moving.
Yeah. So do you see yourself as a person with, I suppose, a foot in each of two islands?
Definitely, yes. Well, I've always seen myself as having two homes, and one of them's here and one of them's down there. And so, when I've been living in this one, I've often visited that one, and that'll be the other way around when we're down there.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's kind of, it grabs you, doesn't it, this place?
Yes, yeah. It does, yes.
Yeah. Well, Janet, thank you very much for popping in this morning.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Also, you know, thank you for your contributions to the island through the Wetland Initiative and the books and so on, and the Gulf News.
Can I say one more thing?
Yeah.
I just want to, you know, I feel a little bit uncomfortable sometimes with the focus on me as the wetland person or me as the conservation person, because there's so many other people on the island who are also really involved in, not just in the weeding and the planting and all of that kind of thing, which is the real hands-on work, but in sort of the advocating, writing submissions, objections, that whole kind of political scene, which is on behalf of the environment as well. So, you know, I'd like to pay tribute to all those people.
Yeah. I mean, there are a number, aren't there? And you've also written about Don Chappell.
Yes, that's right. Don, who's my inspiration. But there's lots of people. And, you know, when I'm sitting at my desk playing around with computers and photographs and things, and those people are out there actually planting things and weeding things, that's where the real action is.
Yeah.
And getting rid of the rats, and that's another whole subject.
Yeah. And what are the things that you think that the people of, you know, if you were going to leave a message to the people of Waiheke saying, you know, I'm away, take care of this for me, what is it that you think people need to look at?
I think it's just getting involved in your own little area, because, you know, there's wetlands in just about every bay. Every little stream needs somebody to look after them. And also there's lots of little groups like the Mackenzie, Friends of Mackenzie, Friends of Newton, Friends of Tiktoki Field. Get involved in one of those groups. There's huge rewards. And get out there on the walks, which, like the Twilight Rambles are coming up, and that somebody will take over the walks that I was involved in organising. So, you know, being out there in the natural world and seeing what is there, and just letting the human world kind of fall behind you a little bit while you're out there, it's that's the best thing.
Great. Janet Hunt, thank you very much. Coming up next Saturday, the 8th of January. Is that a Saturday? Let's turn your mic on. Friday the 8th of January is Roaring Twenties meets Rock and Blues, which is kind of bit of a performance, bit of a party, good time. Is that about it right?
That's probably about right. There's going to be lots of dancing as well. The Otherworld production girls are going to be doing a couple of dances in between all the other stuff that's going on. There's going to be a gambling table at the other end of the hall.
And I'm talking to Aaron Carpenter, by the way, who's one of the performers at Roaring Twenties meets Rock and Blues. So what are you going to be doing there, Aaron?
Well, I'm sort of starting off a little bit later on after the dancing, and myself and Dave Alley will get things sort of warmed up, and then followed by Shane Wills and his danced. He's got overall sort of dancey sets that are lined up. He's got a drummer and a bass player playing with him. So, and we've got a really good sound system that's going to be there, and everything's sort of in place and ready to go. Really,
yeah. So it's kind of like a themed gig, eh?
Everyone's going to be dressed up like gangsters, and the girls will be wearing all their long dresses and maybe a few short dresses as well. And there's going to be really good food there. It's a full menu. And specialty drinks and lots of kind of oyster shots, Bloody Mary oyster shots and prawn cocktails. And, yeah, they've really sort of, you know, they just really want to make it really good, because Sally Ann used to do that such a good job with all her shows. Sort of,
yeah,
it's got to be up to that sort of standard, you know.
That's right, and this is a continuation, isn't it, of Otherworld Productions, which was Sally Ann Stone's initiative.
Yeah, exactly. So we just want to, this is a fundraiser. She used to do fundraisers for everybody else, and we thought, we better do one for ourselves, so we can keep this thing moving along and keep it alive, really.
Yeah. So what's the idea behind Otherworld Productions?
Otherworld Productions is a lot of things, really. It's all about the kids dancing. There's putting on shows for other people. We've got a huge amount of costumes, which will be for hire for this. Sally Ann collected costumes most of her life. She's got lots of stuff left over from Xena and all that sort of thing. So we like to keep that side of it going with this, because Waiheke's full of parties, you know, and everyone needs a costume. So it's all about that as well. And putting on these great shows is a lot of fun and a lot of hard work. And I think that's really important on the island, to have these sorts of parties, you know, to do fundraising for other people as well.
Yeah, and it's kind of just lifts the whole party to a higher level, doesn't it?
I mean, she used to say it you know, if you, everyone gets dressed up, you can sort of take them to another world, even if it's only for 2 or 3 hours. And that's really important for people to get out of themselves and forget about the shit that's going on out there and just have a good time for a few hours.
All right, and give us all the details of tickets and where
the tickets,
and all that
the
stuff.
The tickets are still available at Shop the Rock. I believe there's a few left. I have a funny feeling it's going to sell out because the last gig at Moore Hall did. We've organised a really good bar. There's going to be, you know, lots of interesting drinks, plus there's going to be a bar set up just mainly for beer as well. They've got Sally's Pink Gin available, Giggle Water, which is actually just bubbles, Bank Robberies, which is whiskey and sour. We've organised cabs for the evening. There's going to be cabs, constantly having cabs outside. There's no need to drink and drive and carry on. What else is going to be? There's going to be a feather dance. Pat Ehrlich is on the piano in certain cases. We've got Chris Orange as well doing something as well. I mean, it's just lots and lots and lots of things going on. It's going to be one of those nights you get there and it kind of feels like half an hour and it's all over sort of deal.
Excellent. So $25, Shop the Rock. You can pick up your tickets. And
the doors open at 7, and I think everyone's going to be out of there by 12.
Okay, and what time are you on?
We'll probably be on around about 9:30.
Yeah, and there's entertainment before you as well, isn't there?
Yeah, there's lots of dancing and stuff. And then I think myself and Dave and Shane and that will just sort of just keep going right up to midnight. And just I'll probably have a jam with Shane at some stage, but he's just going to sort of finish the night off, I think.
Cool. And are you going to play us one of the songs you'll be performing on your night?
Yeah, I just thought I'd play a song that sort of... Well, it's going to be all fairly upbeat music the whole time. We're not really... it's just because everyone by that stage would really want to just get up and have a boogie. So I'll just do a song that I'll probably do. I'm not sure if I'm going to do it, but I'll probably will. It's a Muddy Waters song.
Okay, so Aaron's just getting his guitar and gear and everything together, and we can move some stuff around.
Is this mic going here, is it?
Yep, that's all on too. So you've got that for your guitar and the other one for you.
Got my mojo working, but it just don't work on you. I got my mojo working, just don't work on you. I'm gonna love you, pretty girl, just don't know what to do. Well, I'm going down to Louisiana, get me a mojo hand. I'm going down to Louisiana, give me a mojo hand. I'm gonna have all you pretty women rich under my command. Well, I got my mojo working, got my mojo working, I got my mojo working, I got my mojo working. I got my mojo working, but it just don't work on you. Give me my mojo hand. I'm going down to Louisiana. I give me my mojo hand. I'm gonna have all you pretty women rich under my command.
Awesome. Hey, that was great. Thanks, Aaron. Okay, that's Aaron Carpenter live and on Waiheke Radio, and you can see him playing live at Roaring Twenties meets Rock and Blues Mora Hall Friday the 8th of January.
It's going to be shitloads of fun, so come along.
Cool. Cheers, Aaron.
You're listening to Island Life, Waiheke people, events and issues, brought to you by Island, art, craft, giftware, clothing and bric-a-brac, Ocean View Road, Onirua.
It's time to talk to our opinionated Islanders, as we do on the first Saturday of every month. And I've got Alan Knight and Mark James in the studio with me this morning. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Good indeed. Morning, Chris. And happy new decade.
Yeah, happy new decade. And that's really the theme of our talk today, isn't it? As a Absolutely. Look back over Waiheke over the last 10 years. It doesn't, I don't know, does it feel like the change of a decade to you? It's not as momentous as the last one, obviously.
No, not remotely.
Yeah, well, millennia and decade are sort of two orders of magnitude apart, so.
Yeah, that's true.
We have the right to be a little less impressed this time.
Yeah, that's a very mathematical comment for this time of the morning, I must say, Mark.
Ah, well, I must have drunk too much.
I saw a mathematically challenged man the other day at the airport. He was weighing his hand luggage. The reception person said, no, you can't take that on. That's too heavy. You're allowed 7 kilos. And she weighed it. It was 13 kilos. He goes, hold on. He rummaged in his bag. He took out his book, which, by the way, was the Da Vinci Code.
Boring.
And said, oh, weigh it now.
Right.
Anyway, that's a diversion. We are here to talk about Waiheke over the past decade. So how do we sum up 10 years in 20 minutes? Where are we going to start?
Well, I think just before the turn of the century, I had an old friend come up to visit. He came up from the South Island, and I picked him up from the ferry. And I'd been on the island maybe 3 years at that point, and he hadn't been to Waiheke since the 1960s. And said as much as he got in the car. He said, wow, yeah, I haven't been here since about 1966. So we're driving through the island, and I said, so has it changed? And he said, actually, no, it hasn't changed remotely. It's just more houses. He said the feel of the place was absolutely the same. But I'd love to get him back now and ask him if it's changed in the last 10 years. Because what change there's been has been sort of reasonably slow. So 10 years on, I'm not sure it's changed that much. And what change there has been hasn't been too drastic.
And you've been here around 10 years, haven't you, Mark?
Been here almost exactly 10 years. We became Waihikians in February of 2000, so coming up on 10 years for us. And in that period, I honestly expected a lot more change than we actually saw. Because when we moved in, I figured we've got this place is paradise. There's a lot of development pressures. I'll give it 10 years for it still to be paradise. Well, it's been 10 years, and it's still paradise, and it's not quite ready to go away. So I was wrong, and I think that is the that kind of summarizes the change of the decade, which is development and the resistance to it. And the resistance to it was stronger than I expected it to be.
Oh, yes. And didn't we have some fun with the resistance?
Not just personal resistance or you know, organized political resistance, but resistance of the land itself. There have been atrocities, of course, but the place is still just as beautiful as it was 10 years ago. And I think if we brought your friend back from the 60s in 2010, he would agree with that.
Yeah, I think so. It still feels like the same place that I fell in love with when I came here first in 97 and decided on the spot to move here. So I don't think it's changed too badly.
And the pressure for change, I suppose one of the interesting things about that is that the pressure for change hasn't come from the quarters we might have expected. That, you know, a decade ago we might have thought it was those private developers who threatened our way of life, but it turned out to be someone who's meant to be working for us.
Yes.
What relationships between Waiheke and Auckland.
Yeah, I think this has definitely been the decade in which everything has changed in our relationship with Auckland City Council. I mean, 10 years ago, we sort of rubbed along okay, live and let live. I, for one, never felt the urge to decorate the windscreens of council cars with spit the way I do now. You know, walking into the so-called service centre in Ostend, I just have this urge to abuse those people. The rudeness, the arrogance of the council, even with the representatives who live here among us on the island, they're just scum. They really are. And I think it's sad that we've reached that point where we are that antagonistic towards the council. They no longer work for us. They simply leech off us like parasites. And, of course, John Banks hasn't helped with that. You know, the spell that he did in the middle of the decade really showed the way things had changed. He viewed Waiheke as just something to make money out of, regardless of who lived here and the people who actually like the place and moved here because it's a pleasant place to live. I saw him when he came over to look at artworks. And, all he was just sort of sizing everything up, just looking at the size of the land, or what can we do here? Block of flats, that'd be nice. And then there were his comments when he opened Harbour Masters. He got up, he looked around, and the first thing he said, "This is a very expensive piece of real estate." "Ah, thanks, now we know where your priorities are, nasty little worm."
And did we do any better under, of course we've got banks back now, but yes. Did we do any better in the interim with Dick Hubbard?
I don't think we really did.
We did slightly better because of Matiatia. He was on the right side of that issue.
Which was one of the big fights of the decade, wasn't it?
It was one of the biggest, yeah.
So although I'll give him a lot of credit for that. But he, John Banks ran against him in this most recent election, portraying him as a do-nothing mayor, and unfortunately he was not wrong. Dick Hubbard probably started out with his heart in the right place, but didn't know what to do with his hands, and that spelled the doom of his tenancy in the mayor's office.
Yeah, rather like Barack Obama is going to do, I think. Mm-hmm. It'll go the same way. I can't help but get the feeling, looking back on it now, that both Dick Hubbard and the population of Waiheke were thoroughly scammed on that whole Matiatia thing. I'm not sure Will actually had any intention of building that. They simply owned the land and thought, how do we get top dollar for this? I know. Let's think of the most unacceptable development we can possibly think of. We know the locals will be up in arms about it, and rather than get a certain amount of money from the council, we could maybe double our money on it, and I have a feeling that's what happened.
Well, yeah, and a lot of those changes that were proposed for down there are probably coming back while we're not that focused on it. You know, the transport changes and moving the bus stops and all of those kind of things seem to be back on the agenda.
Although not the retail stuff. I mean, that's something we're really noticing this year. There's always been this talk about, more retail space, more shops and cafes and stuff like this. Have you seen how much retail space is standing empty right now? And there's never been anything but a glut of retail space since I've been here. There's always been shops available and standing empty, and never more so than they are now. This is not a shopping destination.
Not only that, but the combination of the recession and the higher ferry fares has really done damage to what retail infrastructure there is. And only the gold card has kept things afloat, really.
Although I'd have to say, this year, don't you get the feeling, looking at the teeming streets, that this year's influx of guests over this period of the year are people who, in previous years, would have been sitting on the beach in Fiji or Rarotonga, and this year you can't afford it, can you, folks? So you're here with us. Welcome. Please spend all your money.
That's an interesting thought. I was under the impression, and of course I haven't done any counting or anything, this is just an impression, that the influx this year was less than the influx, let's say, 5 years ago. That the crush of traffic is not as bad as it was then. And I would have written that up to the recession, but I'm not sure. I'm not even sure that that's true. It's just a feeling.
No,
that
I'm
I
not
have.
Even sure that's true, actually. I think the influx over this time of year, about 5 years ago, was less than it is now. But that was down on, say, the late 90s. Christmas, you couldn't move on the island. It was really, really busy. And I thought that tended to fall off a little bit, both Christmas and Easter. That when the jazz festival sort of peaked around 10 years ago, Easter you couldn't move on the island, and that's been quieter. There hasn't been quite the
and that's something which was something that people identified with the island, which is now gone, isn't it? The jazz festival,
yeah. Great shame. That used to be magnificent. I'm not a jazz fan, but I would never have got to see anything because I was running beer kegs around. We used to get through vast amounts of beer.
What are the other things that have disappeared from island life over the last 10 years that you miss or don't miss?
Um, Ooh, that's a difficult one.
It is, you know, because things that disappear tend to come back.
Yeah.
Like we lost the cinema, then we got it back.
We lost the speed humps, and instead we got the sleepers at Onitangi.
Oh, yes. Now the speed bumps.
No, we got the speed bumps, then lost them back. You know, there's a good one.
Yeah, so the speed bumps, that was a very interesting one, because, I mean, there is a pretty confirmed rumor going around of who did it. I'm not going to say, but, you know, you're out there, you know who you are. What I would love to have seen was how quickly they must have worked to get all those bolts out of the ground, and they'd have needed an angle grinder to shear all the bolts down to the level with the road.
It was a well-organized, you know, operation of military precision.
Yes.
Very impressive.
Yes. It had all the hallmarks of well-organized people on the island, and there are only a few of those. We're not the best organized people here. As I say, you know who you are. I'd love to know what they did with them, though.
A trophy? It's an odd trophy, isn't it?
Not as odd as concrete ram's testicles.
No, that's true.
Which, incidentally, are back and stuck on now with a padlock, which I think is most amusing.
I saw that this morning. I didn't have time to have a look. So these are just kind of hanging underneath, aren't they? Padlocked
yes.
on.
Yeah. And they're stuck on with wire, and there's a padlock holding them on. So presumably they can be removed for maintenance, which is an interesting prospect.
But that there is a rumor about that they now have a radio transmitter hidden inside, so if they ever get stolen again.
Oh, that's an interesting one, isn't it? Yes, a little locator beacon in them.
Now, the other thing that disappeared or came and went during the decade were some cheerleaders of change, the newspaper, the Waiheke Week.
Oh, that was most amusing. We were just discussing this, weren't we? It started in 2004... as the sort of basically the voice of the grumpy pro-development National Party vote on the island, which has never been very big, and so it proved. It was a flimsy piece of work and very belligerently run. But its editor its proprietor was heard to say when the paper was first launched, there's only room for two papers on the island. So at least he got one thing right in his newspaper career. There was indeed only room for two, and lo and behold, it folded.
And were you sad to see it go?
I was thrilled. I suppose sad to see it go in that it provided me with a few minutes entertainment each week, just looking at the ludicrous pomposities that they wrote. But it dwindled like an anorexic. It was a very sad piece of work.
What was your take on the Waiheke Week, Mark?
Well, I was. It came onto the island pretending to be the wave of the future for the island. In other words, Waiheke will be developed. It will be the home of rich people, most of whom will vote national, and we are the voice of those people. We are the future. We will take over.
Resistance is useless.
Exactly. And it was very satisfying to see that prediction fail.
Mm. Although they may be right about the move to national voting.
I would interpret that as more a temporary thing that happened in 2008 and will not repeat. But it could be. It could be that it's not really Waiheke turning into a wealthy national voters' paradise that caused that move to the National Party in 2008. It may be that people were simply less inspired by the Labour Party than they had been in previous elections.
Yeah, and let's face it, our previous Labour MP really didn't. She'd got to the point where she wasn't inspiring anybody. I always found her a very patronising and rather stodgy local MP, whereas Nikki Kay, bless her, has been quite a tower of strength for the island. She's done quite well. I think we were talking about this last time. One of the beauties of MMP. You can may not agree with the party, but if you can spot a good local candidate, then you can have them whilst not voting for their party. But I think also any influx there has been of the more conservative voter to the island, these tend to be the temporary Waihikians, the ones who only turn up at this time of year, and their houses are shuttered up around the time of elections. they're all living in, back in the city. So, no, as far as the permanent population here goes, I don't think there is much of a... That support for parties like National has not grown.
And would you be willing to pick a person of the decade, someone who stands out, who summarises the last 10 years here for you? I know you've got some highlights. I know you've got some particular favourites amongst the current community board.
Yes.
I mean, we've lost some real characters, haven't we? I mean, John Chappell, you know, there's
one. Hubbard.
Tim Hubbard, mm. Yeah.
Yeah. As well as people who've just moved off island, like Bruce Bissett. Certainly miss him. Now, there was a great community board member.
The community board is, I mean, how do you think that, do you think that's changed? Is it always like it is now? Or do you think there's something different going on there? I mean, it seems at the moment there's a, I don't know, it's not so much infighting, is it? But there's just, there's something a bit lost there somewhere.
It's an end game for this kind of community board. You know, as soon as the super city comes in, it'll be replaced by something whose outlines we are only now dimly beginning to perceive.
Mm.
And so I can imagine that the personalities on the present board are... not exactly sitting ducks, but they may feel less involved than they would have, let's say, 2 years ago.
I'd say yes. Over the decade, I'm just like time picking their person of the year. It isn't always somebody good, and I suppose in that spirit, I'd have to say Noble Angelo would have to be high up on the list. He was a disaster. I mean, anyone who voted for him clearly wasn't reading the label. I think it's a shame that he was silenced so quickly, because he was a lot of fun to poke fun at.
And what about our councillors? We've had three over the last decade, if I recall. So Greg Davenport, was he in the last decade? And then Faye Storer, of yes. course. And then Denise Roach, yes. the current one. So how would you rate them? I can't remember whether Greg was in this decade or not.
I don't think so.
No, I don't think so. I think, yeah. Well, pretty much the decade, as far as the councillors, was it's been Faye Storer all the way through. Mm. I thought she did a magnificent job.
Mm.
She represented the island very, very well. But I think her eventual downfall was due to the fact that she was perceived on the island, rightly or wrongly, as being too... She'd gone native with Auckland City. She was a bit more interested in cutting deals with other councillors and stuff like that, which, yeah, from her point of view, that might have been a good idea. From where we were all sitting, it's like, no, just stand up for the island. Dig your heels in, get a bit more bolshy.
Well, she was certainly very big on signs, I recall, towards the end.
Yes, that was not a good idea. I mean, suggesting, for example, that lovely sign across the road here on Steve Hill's butcher shop would be taken down. Why? That's a brilliant piece of work. And I think the island would have been poorer for losing that. And I mean, we were all against ugly signage, but really, come on, I think she did go a bit far on that one.
Mm. And Mark, what's your take on these councillors?
Well, in spite of the fact that Faye Storer made a few mistakes like that, I think she was an excellent representative for the island. I'm sure that she was voted out by the thinnest of margins, largely because of that principle that you simply get tired of politicians after a certain length of time. You know, the nappy principle. You know, politicians should be changed regularly, just like nappies, and for the same reason. in her case, it was an injustice. I mean, I certainly got nothing against the present councillor, but who I think is doing quite well. It was an injustice to Faye after all she'd done to get voted out by that small margin.
Mm.
So we have a new phase ahead of us. We have the super city on the horizon, and I mean, you were just saying that, you know, 10 years ago you predicted that there would be change, and it didn't really occur to the degree to which you thought it would. What do you think for the 10 years ahead?
Well, the super city stuff, I'm just bogged down in the details. I can't follow it.
I'm afraid of it. You know, it started out so promising with the Royal Commission identifying disconnections between government and people. that was exactly the right thing to identify. And, of course, it's been taken over and completely turned around by forces who want to increase that disconnection. And that I'm afraid of that.
I think, though, the whatever the larger picture, when you get right down to it, when the dust has settled and everything's been changed around and Auckland's a super city, we'll still be dealing with the same lazy, venal, worthless council employees that we're dealing with now. That nothing's going to change there. You'll still be scowled at when you walk into the service centre. The chances are, I mean, let's be frank about it, Auckland City is becoming like Sydney. That corruption didn't used to exist, now it does. We've all seen that in the past decade. People getting consent for stuff that is not in the plan because something's changed hands. Somebody's been approached and paid off. The wheelie bins, I think, another thing there. There was so clearly something very fishy about the way that those were foisted on us. I was glad to see that, incidentally, that the decision to do that got, what was it called, the Roger Award?
Yeah, they got the accomplice Christmas. And the Roger Awards, which are the corporate, I suppose, the corporate bad guys awards. Yeah.
You know, that was clearly a corrupt decision to do that. And I think there's more and more of that. And what I fear with the Super City is that those same people, with their hands in the till or their hands in our pockets, will just, there'll be even less control on them. And that it really will be, it'll become like a third world country or like Sydney, where, oh, you want something from the council? How much have you got?
So do you have those, I mean, your fears are slightly different at that market. It's more about the as you say, that disconnection. Do you think we're going to go down that corruption route? Or?
Well, I'm afraid that the two go hand in hand. You know, once you get a body with so much power and that has so little accountability to the electorate, there's no checks on them. There's no checks and balances in that kind of a system. And so, yes, that's you're asking for corruption, but that's a byproduct.
And if you got off the ferry from Auckland and, you know, maybe, I don't know, got on the bus and caught the bus out to Onitangi, what do you think you'd see different in 10 years' time?
More houses.
Yeah. Oh, well, more ugly monstrosities like that thing that replaced McGinty's.
Yeah.
That was a piece of appalling evil to perpetrate down that end of the beach. If I ever met the developer that did that, I'd punch him in the face. That was just vile. Every time I walk past there, I'm just depressed by it. And the thought that there'd be more buildings like that is really very sad.
And that is a symbol of what has gone on in the last 10 years that really is different. There is a lot more... I won't say there are more wealthy people on the island than there were 10 years ago, but the kind of wealthy people that are here are the ones without taste.
Yeah.
They're the ones for whom architecture is an expression of wealth and nothing more.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, there have been some wealthy people who have moved to the island and have designed houses of extraordinary beauty that fit in and are just perfect. And then you get things like that. And, of course, Palm Beach has the same thing. There's that new development gone in there. I fear we're doomed to see more of that, and I think it's a huge shame, particularly since those places just stand empty during most of the year. They're only busy between now and Easter.
Well, we can only hope you're wrong.
Yeah. I hope we are.
Yeah, and we can come back in 10 years' time and check it out. Good stuff. The Opinionated Islanders, Alan Knight and Mark James, joining us in the studio. They'll be back next month on the first Saturday of the month to talk about whatever is happening around the island. And yeah, but depressing today, really.
Well, I suppose so, yeah. But, you know, it's been a horrible decade. I think we were saying this the other night. If we come in and talk about the last decade, it's going to be a bit gloomy. But then, yeah, what can you do? It was a gloomy decade. Yeah. Even Her Majesty pointed this out the other day, and 2009 was a rotten year.
Yeah, well, I suppose, you know, there's that spectre, I think, of, you know, the 9/11 just kind of hung over the decade for the whole world, really, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly has.
Yeah. K, coming up this coming week is a new idea, quite an exciting idea, quite a nice idea, which is the plum drive, or the what are you calling it? I've got Jennifer Clamp here to talk to us about it. So what are you calling this thing, Jennifer?
The Great Waiheke Plum Drive.
Great Waiheke Plum Drive. So what's the idea behind it all?
So the idea behind it is, well, the concept behind it is that people donate excess plums, because this time of year plums are coming into season, and for a lot of people their plum trees are dropping a lot of fruit that they're not able to use. So the idea is we collect up all of that fruit that would otherwise go to waste. People donate their empty jars and we spend a day making jam.
Okay, so I mean there are a lot of plums around, and you see people putting out, you know, little bags for kids, selling bags of them, or there's a bucket load out there and saying help yourself. So the idea is to kind of take all of that and make something of it.
So on one day, which is going to be the Thursday the 7th, we've taken the Palm Beach Hall. We're basically turning it into a kitchen to make jam for the day. So the idea is that if somebody wants to drop off a bag or a bucket of plums on the day, then they can come along at the end of the day and pick up a jar of jam. So it's a project that is self-funding, and giving back to the community and taking what would otherwise be waste and turning it into something productive.
Yeah, so how did the idea come about? Who's behind it all?
Well, it's a number of individuals that are behind it. James Samuel, who is part of the Transition, I can't remember the exact name for it. Behind that. And Pete, who's behind Ubi. And then there are a couple of us that are involved independently, who are just passionate about...
jam.
Yeah, sustainable food, sustainable food systems. So, you know, using what's local and organic, and making sure food doesn't go to waste, and... keeping it local and sustainable.
Yep. So the idea is what? People gather up all of their plums and they bring them along, or they're collected, or how would that work?
Okay, so it can be done two ways. We've had a couple of articles in the paper, and there have been some flyers around town with phone numbers. So if somebody wasn't able to drop down the plums on the day, which is the ideal scenario, then we can come pick up a bag of plums in the morning. We also need clean jars with the labels removed, so that we have something to put the jam in. And so we're asking people if they could, again, drop them on the day, that would be fantastic. Otherwise, the Red Cross and the SPCA also collecting jars for us. And we really want people to come and take part too. So the idea is that, you know, not only do you kind of get to trade either your plums or your jars or some time, but you also get to learn how to make jam so that people can be making jam at home.
And I've never made jam.
No.
Is it an intensive process?
It's actually quite easy.
Yeah.
So James and I met with Maureen, who owns Traffic Jam, who you might have seen down the market, and talked to her. I'm a project manager by profession, and I've taken some time off, so I thought this would be a great project to get involved with. So I said to James, well, we need to understand what the process is so we know how long it's going to take and how much jam we're actually going to get out of it and how many bags of plums we can handle on the day. And so we sat down with Maureen and went through the process, and I think I figured it out to be about a 12-step process, but cutting up the fruit probably isn't the biggest part of it. Just stirring the jams on the stove and heating the sugar and adding the sugar. It's probably the cooling that takes the longest.
Right, and then getting it all in the jars. And so you're going to be there for a while, aren't you?
Yeah, I figured out that end-to-end it would take about 3 hours to make one batch.
Right, okay. And
but there's a lot of standing around there, so don't think it's too much hard work.
No, I can imagine it's going to be hot and sticky, though.
Hot and sticky.
Yeah. So any idea how many plums you've got coming in? Are the trees laden this year?
I have heard the trees are laden. We've definitely had some excited people that are, or some people that are excited about finding somewhere useful to give their plums. I don't actually know the exact figures because I haven't been taking the phone calls, but I know we've definitely got some bags of plums coming in. We need 20 bags in total at least 20 bags of plums to be able to hit our capacity for the day, which should be around 240 jars is our absolute top limit, and that would be about 20 bags of plums is what we figured out. But from what I've heard, that's not hard. A friend of mine said they were...
I mentioned there's trees that you could get 4 or 5 bags off.
Yeah, yeah. Well, a friend said in about 10 minutes she managed to fill 2 big plastic bags the other night, so I think it should be okay. Quite possible.
And why the upper limit? Why 240 jars? It's just the capacity of the kitchen? Or?
Yeah, it's a mixture of the capacity of the kitchen, the number of hobs that we've got, and the number of jars that come out of one batch. I actually thought you'd get more jars out of one preserving pot. I thought you'd probably get about 20, but you actually get about 12 out of one preserving pot.
You are very well organised.
I really am. Yeah.
You don't want to run a radio station, do you?
Yes. Yeah, I don't think James kind of realised how anal project managers were when he signed me up. But there we go. It should run smoothly at least.
Excellent. And have you worked out what you can do with the stones?
No. Well, actually, some of them stay in the jam. We'll skim a lot of them off when the plums are boiling. But
it
some
helps
of them
it set
stay
or something, doesn't it?
They yeah. contain pectin, so they yeah. help it to set. Absolutely. But afterwards, what are we going to do with the waste? Maybe we'll have to find some. We'll
compost.
Have to find a compost. Yeah. Absolutely, it's about sustainability.
Excellent. Well, it sounds great. So people can. What are the phone numbers for people to ring up?
Okay. Well, I've got a couple of numbers here. People can text through. So if they want to donate jars, so we're asking people to donate. Basically, the idea is that if you give us 10 jars, you get a jar of jam back. Or a bag of plums, you get a jar of jam back. And I don't think I've emphasized enough, people come along on the day. That's what we'd really love to see. And if you want to help out for a little while, we're also giving people jam in payment for their time to come and help out. But also we're going to have other stuff going on there. We're going to have people making crepes, and we've got a guy coming along with sills showing us how to make alcohol out of plums. And we'll have all the process up on the wall too. So if you just want to come and see how to make jam, you can read all the signs and understand how it's all done. But the numbers, if you want to text through to get involved, it's 0274-372-082. That's 0274-372-082 or call 372-8737.
Okay, and any time up to Thursday morning?
Yeah.
Really, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, and people can just drop stuff down as well?
Yeah, drop down some jars or plums in the morning. We want to start cooking at 9 o'clock, but we will be staggering the batches throughout the day. But if you need us to come and pick up plums or jars, we're going to do that pick-up run between 8 and 10. So text through what it is that you'd like to donate, or be it jars or plums, or if you want to take part. And if you need us to come pick it up, text through your address too.
Yeah, it's a nice idea. And have you thought about any other crops that you might turn your attention to?
Absolutely. I think the next is apples, and I think after that it's feijoas, or maybe it's the other way around.
Oh, yeah, feijoas. But there's always heaps of them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, good stuff. Excellent. Okay, well, thank you very much. It's Jennifer Clamp. Does the group have a name?
No, it's just the Great Waiheke Plum Drive.
Excellent. Coming up this Thursday, the 7th of January. Thanks very much, Jennifer.
You've been listening to the interviews from last Saturday's Island Life, our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. Island Life is brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, and the interviews are replayed on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock. They're also available as a download from our website, www.waihekiradio.org.nz. Island Life is brought to you by Island, the shop with Waiheke's most eclectic collection of local art, craft, giftware, clothing and bric-a-brac. Island, Ocean View Road, Onirola.